I'm Chris O'Connor from Duke University, here with Alex Mabaza, and we hope to have a very exciting session. We're going to have presentations that go 10 to 15 minutes, followed by, without further ado, we will have our first speaker, Dr. Michael Felker, who is an associate professor of medicine and director of heart failure research at Duke University Medical Center, and he's talking on a host of trials and drugs that are still under investigation. Mike?
Thanks, Chris, and good morning or afternoon, everybody. I think my assigned title was New Agents for Heart Failure Still Under Development. That's about a six-hour topic, so I have about 400 slides. I hope you all will be patient. No, I'm just going to touch briefly with this disclaimer that this is in no way a comprehensive attempt to cover all the agents currently under development. I'm just going to touch on three in various stages of development in the hopes that that'll be illustrative for our discussion. Relaxin, omecamtiv mecarbil, and a drug that doesn't yet have a name, TRV027. And again, this is there are many others that we could have focused on. But so first, relaxin, which is the furthest along. It's completed a phase 3 study, and as many people are now aware, relaxin is the hormone that mediates the hemodynamic changes of pregnancy, which include increases in cardiac output, decreases in SVR, and increases in renal blood flow, all of which would seem to be favorable hemodynamic effects in a patient with heart failure. And so this has been tested now in a phase 2 program and a recently completed phase 3 trial, which I'll go over here briefly. The RELAX-AHF study, just to highlight a couple of important aspects of the inclusion criteria, the patient population studied. The intent in designing this trial was really to try to focus on a population most likely to benefit from a drug whose at least one mechanism of action was as a vasodilator. So two aspects I think are noteworthy. One is that we focused on patients with elevated blood pressure, which as we know is a majority of patients who present to the hospital with acute heart failure, you needed a blood pressure of 125 or greater to enter the study. And then the additional factor is we tried to randomize people very early, within 16 hours. And I think of the big trials, certainly this trial had the shortest time to randomization from presentation, which we think early treatment at least is an important potential feature of benefit. So this slide just outlines the sort of efficacy measures and the time points. The primary endpoint of the trial was dyspnea, using two different measures of dyspnea, one 24 hours by the Likert scale and the other over 5 days using the visual analog scale, and a variety of additional efficacy endpoints, which I'll touch on. And just to briefly go through the results, this is the primary endpoint for dyspnea relief over 5 days with a visual analog scale showing a highly statistically significant improvement in dyspnea with relaxin, a mean difference of 448 millimeter hours, which of course is not a metric that has any potential or particular resonance clinically. This represents about a 20% improvement in dyspnea if you want to try to give a relative treatment effect that might be more in line with what we're used to thinking about with serelaxin over placebo. Interestingly, the other primary endpoint, which was also dyspnea, but focused on 24-hour relief of dyspnea using a relative scale, so a Likert scale, how do you feel now compared to how you felt before randomization. And using this metric, there was a nominal improvement at each time point with relaxin over placebo, of borderline statistical significance at the individual time points, but collectively, as defined in the protocol, the primary endpoint of proportion of patients with moderately or markedly better dyspnea at each time point, well, there was no difference between the two. So for relevant to our later discussion, an interesting disconnect between two different ways of measuring dyspnea in the same study. The secondary endpoints, there were two. They both were neutral. One was 60-day composite of cardiovascular death or heart failure rehospitalization. You can see there was actually a non-statistically significant trend towards a fewer deaths, but a higher number of hospitalizations, leading to a hazard ratio of essentially one for the 60-day endpoint. The other pre-specified secondary endpoint was days alive and out of hospital, which was also neutral. But then the finding which has gotten a lot of attention, which is represented here, there was a decrease, about a 30%, a 37% decrease in cardiovascular death through day 180. This was not a secondary endpoint, but was an additional efficacy endpoint pre-specified in the protocol. This was also true for all-cause mortality, which was a pre-specified safety endpoint. And so there's been a lot of discussion, and I'm sure we'll have some more, about whether this is believable or real. So in trying to drill down on what potentially could have explained this, I would say, surprising mortality effect, we did and continue to look in more detail at some of the early features of treatment differences. And as you can see, there's a fairly marked improvement in proportion of patients experiencing this intermediate endpoint of worsening heart failure with serelaxin compared to a placebo. And then when we look at biomarker differences, and these are all post hoc analysis, but simply looking at the biomarker profile through the first 2 days of treatment, what you can see is that serelaxin treatment is associated with a substantially greater proportion of patients having favorable changes in NT-proBNP, and potentially importantly, if you believe that this sort of end organ injury or dysfunction in the early phase can affect post-discharge outcomes, there's about half as many patients had worsening renal function. There's a lower incidence of troponin increase and a greater resolution of liver function test abnormalities. So still a lot going on, obviously, in this data set, and a very active area. But that's relaxing. So in the interest of time, I'm just going to touch briefly on a couple of other programs. One is omecamtiv mecarbil, very interesting drug. Omecamtiv mecarbil is an activator of cardiac myosin, so it affects the interaction between actin and myosin in the myocyte, and essentially increases the number of cross bridges formed, and has some very interesting hemodynamic effects in that it, and this is from a dog model, it actually increases the duration of systolic contraction, but not the speed of systolic contraction. So when compared to traditional inotrope like dobutamine, you can see there's this increase in the slope, the DPDT, with the dobutamine, and actually contraction is actually, the duration of contraction is shorter with omecamtiv mecarbil. The slope is similar, but the duration of contraction is longer, so the systolic ejection time increases, leading to greater stroke volume. Interestingly, this can somebody can advance?
Qu'on peut avancer la diapo, s'il vous plaît.
Oh, thank you. So compared to traditional inotropes, at least in dog models, this hasn't been tested in humans, there does appear to be no increase in myocardial oxygen consumption, and this is not associated with increases in intercellular calcium. So both those features at least suggest the possibility that this drug could overcome some of the limitations of traditional inotropes, which, as we all know, have been very disappointing in clinical trials. So in humans, and this is John Cleland's work, in patients with heart failure, we know the drug increases stroke volume and systolic ejection time, as you might expect based on its mechanism of action, and decreases volumes. There's currently an ongoing phase 2B trial, the ATOMIC AHF study, using an ascending dose design, looking at three doses. We're just entering the third cohort now with a primary endpoint of dyspnea over 48 hours, as well as a variety of secondary endpoints like you might expect. So very interesting mechanism of action, very interesting program. We'll hopefully have some results from this study in 2013. And then finally, just briefly, a drug which is very early in development, but I think quite interesting. This was actually a spinoff of Bob Lefkowitz's lab, and our moderator, Dr. O'Connor, is Bob's boss, and He takes credit for Bob having won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry this year. So he receives a small portion of the prize as chief of cardiology. So this all spun out of Bob Lefkowitz's laboratory and his fundamental work on the way G-protein coupled receptors work. So we know angiotensin II, when it binds the AT1 receptor, it works through both G-protein effects causing vasoconstriction and fluid retention, but also through this non-G-protein beta-arrestin-mediated pathway. And traditional ARBs block the receptor, and they block all these pathways, of course, which has favorable effects on blood pressure and fluid retention, but also have been shown to actually acutely at least decrease cardiac output via this beta arrestin pathway. So the question is, can you have a biased ligand that affects some of these but not others? And that's really the idea behind this experimental molecule, TRV027, which blocks the G-protein coupled pathways but agonizes the beta arrestin pathways. And so if you if you see you give agonist, you see you activate both pathways in the red and black lines here. If you give a traditional ARB, you block both pathways, of course. And if you give this molecule TRV027, can you go back? What you see is you agonize the beta arrestin pathway while blocking a traditional G-protein pathway. In animal models, at least, this drug has very interesting hemodynamic effects. They seem to be tied to the degree of plasma renin activity and RAS activation. There's a phase 2A study that's been completed but not yet presented publicly, and a phase 2B study coming. So in conclusion, I think although there's a lot of talk about the death of acute heart failure trials, I think it's still an area of obviously active investigation and hopefully some successes after a long path of many failures. So I thank you for your attention.
Any comments or questions? Chris.
The Mike, there's so many outstanding issues that you've raised from this provocative talk, and I think that the positive signals out of RELAX-HF have really done a greater contribution to the field than the individual drug itself. Although we're hopeful that both will pan out in the long term, but I think, and I know Alex will get into this, but in the dose study, the LASIK study that you led and we were involved with, we also used VOS for dyspnea. How did the magnitude of difference compare with what we see in RELAX-HF?
Yeah. So that's a great question. And one of the, and maybe we'll get into this later in the dyspnea talk, one of the challenges is, and the journals in all the cases have pressed for this, is what's a minimum clinically important difference in the VAS score? Like what is a meaningful change. This is in the one metric where the Likert has a little more face validity. If a patient says, I feel moderately better, they're telling you this is a clinically important difference that I'm experiencing, where the VAS is just implied. The magnitude, if you adjust for the difference in duration, so dose was over 72 hours, this was over 5 days, the magnitude of dyspnea relief and relaxin was higher than the difference between the low dose and high dose groups. It's about a 30% greater dyspnea relief than between low dose and high dose groups in the dose study.
Yeah, Marco.
Just to follow up, I think it's very important to point out that this difference was achieved with a lower dose of furosemide in RELAX-HF. So that the group assigned to serelaxin received lower doses of furosemide compared to the group on placebo. And this is one, as you, Chris, have pointed out, I mean, I think the design of the trial is important because It was designed to, of course, to favor the finding of some favorable effect. And with this early administration of the drug, we really have a regimen which is based on higher doses of furosemide, and actually also higher doses of inotropes, even dopamine, compared to a regimen which is based mainly on serelaxin. And this may also explain some differences in biomarkers and in renal function between the two regimens. And of course, if we added the drug administered in patients resistant to therapy, like it was done in the early days with levosimendan, for example, you cannot see this.
In fact, I'm going to echo this, and Michael, I was going to ask you the same question, and I think Chris was also alluding to this. Do you believe that Relax is positive, and really we are very happy because of the drug or because of the design? I hope Novartis is not in the room, but because this is important. I mean, if you feel that, let's say, 90% is related to the design, as Mark was saying, this means that maybe we should bring all the drugs that were negative, at least part of them that were negative in the past, and basically... Exactly, and we do the trials.
Yeah. I'm not sure Marco was saying it was, and I'll speak for him, but I'm not sure he was saying it was totally because of the design. I mean, you can't, anything I said would be pure speculation, of course. I think we did some things right in the design. We targeted a certain population we thought was going to benefit, and we focused on enrolling people as early as possible, which many of the trials, of course, have done. I think it would be, this would be a different. I think the magnitude of the signals seen in this trial don't seem to me to be just a difference in design, but anything I said would be just speculation. Marco's the principal investigator, so he can comment if he wants.
Sorry, but of course if you don't have a drug which is active, no design will be effective. But it's also important to point out that we must start to design studies in a way to favor a positive finding, and then of course you need something which is active, otherwise. So it's both.
Indeed, but unfortunately, probably we had some active drugs in the past that didn't pass the exam and the test because we are learning so much, including in Relax. I mean, even maybe more in Relax than in other trials. We learned many, many new tricks. Adrian?
Well, there's one more thing that might have been related to the success has been the careful measurement of blood pressures and only including those with high blood pressures. You made me remember this when you talked about the previous trials that included the low blood pressure people as well that might have jeopardized the outcome of finally of the trial. And this trial was very, very precise in stopping rules about when the blood pressure drop was too high, and I think that might have also been part of success. But I fully agree that without a drug that works, you never have a positive trial.
And this brings also the importance of all the surveys that were done showing that blood pressure is a very good indicator of phenotypes and acute heart failure.
John?
Yep. Hi. Over here. Hi, Alex. I think that Relax is really a groundbreaker study. It's potentially going to be do for acute heart failure, what ACE inhibitors did for chronic heart failure. And I really hope that we can prove that, and I think it's going to take another trial to do that. We should remember we've got pre-Relax, which went the same way, and if you start to look at all-cause mortality and add in pre-Relax, you know, things are beginning to look quite impressive. So you do feel that perhaps you don't need such a large study to really nail it down, but the big question is going to be against what? Now, we don't have very good evidence that nitrates work, but some countries, and indeed ESC guidelines quite strongly advocate them, and they are widely used in some people's clinical practice, but the evidence isn't that good. And if you compare your new agent against nitrates, where nitrates haven't really nailed the problem down, then that's a problem. I don't think there's any option but to go for a three-way study where you have a control group, nitrates and relaxin, maybe have to be an interesting adaptive clinical design, but I think before this is ready for prime time, we have to answer both questions.
Thank you. Mihai?
I'd like to ask the panelists, it's not about Relax, it's about the concept. Do you really believe that for a chronic condition, a drug given for 2 days, no matter how good the drug is, can improve long-term outcomes?
No.
Well, the answer is yes, and Mihai told us that years ago. You focused on this idea of the raised troponin, and relaxin in some ways may be much more like thrombolysis than like a nitrate in a vasodilator.
Yes, there are some issues. Mihai showed with, and Mike Felker actually, with Mirinon in Optime HF, it had the short-term infusion was associated with a long-term increase in mortality. And this has been shown also with inotropes. So there are drugs which have been associated with a long-term increase in mortality as well. And just simply because the number of deaths increases with the longer follow-up. Second, with the biomarkers, and this is shown also in the paper which is now going to be online soon in JCC, with all the biomarkers, the short-term changes at 2 days were also associated with the divergence of the survival curves up to 180 days. And so I think it is possible. Of course, we need further data, and I think that the concept I like is that we are getting close, we are learning to conduct trials in patients hospitalized for heart failure, and we are probably getting closer to have better trials. We are having better and better trials, but that's it.
Chris, may I answer the question? Both John and Mark, first of all, we should not confuse safety with efficacy. Uptime was a question of doing harm in patients with CAD who would develop low blood pressure. Going back to what John said, 10 years ago, the hypothesis that we all had, there's lots of injury. Unfortunately, in the last 10 years, increase. Maybe is a better person to answer. I'm not seeing that much injury that was hypothesized 10 years ago.
So a lot of good comments. I mean, I do think we are certainly seeing a lot of injury. If you look at the trials like ASCEND and Relaxin, the proportion of patients who have who meet the universal definition of MI at presentation is about 50%. So in ASCEND, exactly 50% of the patients had baseline troponin above the upper reference limit for myocardial infarction. So I think there is a lot of injury. I think another trial needs to be done, what it should look like, as you might imagine, is a matter of a lot of discussion. I think one way of phrasing what Marco said, which I think is that we know from all kinds of trials, and this holds up in Relaxin, that there's a biomarker profile of effects which is associated with good long-term outcomes, effective drop in natriuretic peptides, avoiding myocyte injury, avoiding worsening renal function, all those things. There's a profile that we say this is short-term success that we know has a strong association with long-term success. And in the Relaxin trial, at least, more patients randomized to serelaxin developed that favorable profile compared to those that didn't. So whether you think that's sufficient biologic plausibility or not, people disagree. But
yeah, I'm sorry, we need to move on. I see other questions, but we need to move on because we already are late after the first presentation. I think we're doing very well, Chris.